they came to Singapore when there was nothing but jungle and pig farmers. It was a snake here eating an apple. You know what I mean? And they built all of this. Now, they're the landlords of the most expensive city in the world. These people are so posh and snobby, they're snoshy.
I don't think anyone could write a personality like Awkwafina brings to the screen. A lot of it was her improvisation, but there were the things that we wrote that part once we knew we had her.
Oh, yes. Rap star and actress Awkwafina, she's a scene stealer in John M. Chu's new movie, Crazy Rich Asians. The director will join us to talk about why this movie is so personal for him and for many of his actors. It's the first time in more than two decades that we have a major Hollywood studio film with an all-Asian cast. That's later in the show. But first, New York just became the first American city to cap the total number of ride-hail vehicles and set a wage floor for the ride-hail drivers. It's a win for Uber drivers and their peers who make about as much as minimum wage workers. And it's a huge blow to Uber corporate, which has, in the past, insisted that raising driver pay couldn't be done. Joining us now to talk about the decision and what it says about the state of the gig economy as a whole is Sarah Kessler. Sarah is an editor at Quartz and the author of the book Gigged, The End of the Job and the Future of Work. Hello, Sarah.
Hello.
Nice to have you on the show. This isn't the first time New York City has tried to cap Uber's growth or regulate it. It tried to do it back in 2015, but that just went nowhere. So what's changed between then and now?
So a couple of things. One thing is that in 2015, there were about 60,000 for-hire drivers in New York City, and now there are about 100,000, and that includes taxis and everything else. The other thing is that over the last few months, there's been six taxi drivers that have committed suicide and cited kind of competition from Uber as a reason.
Right. Basically, they'd bought medallions and watched the worth of them basically disappear when Uber got into the market. Right.
But exactly. Yeah.
But New York's something of a special case when it comes to taxis and the rideshare business. So many people, such a larger market, and other cities aren't as dependent on that sector. So how are other cities treating ridesharing services like Uber and Lyft?
Yeah, it's true that most other cities don't have the same medallion system, but other cities have also tried to regulate Uber in one way or another. In Seattle, for instance, the city council passed a law that Uber drivers and Lyft drivers could unionize, which has faced some legal challenges. Austin tried to change the way that these companies were handling their background checks for drivers, and eventually kind of Uber and Lyft said, fine, you want to regulate us, we're just going to leave. But Uber did eventually return. So there have been small steps to try to regulate these companies.
Well, do you see a larger significance, in this move by New York City, especially if other cities follow suit? Does it indicate any kind of shift in our thinking about the gig economy as a whole or the status of the economy?
I think it does. I think that these companies kind of, when they started, their stance was, we are only software. We're just this neutral marketplace where people, you know, work and find clients, workers, and that's it. So we don't have any responsibility for the outcomes of what our cars do on the street or how our workers get paid. And I think that that's really being challenged in a big way.
You know, I've been saying this phrase, gig economy, I said it about four times talking to you already, but I was interested to see that you've written that that's really outdated by now, that maybe we are reaching a place with this kind of labor that it's being folded into the mainstream larger labor pool. As more people enter this market, more workers, freelancers are saying, look, I'm not making enough to make a living. And I know that you've said today, in the 90s, we called any company with a website an internet company. And today, that's just ridiculous. That phrase sounds silly. I expect the same will happen with the term gig economy.
Yeah, and really I think it is that there's been kind of a trend since the 70s where companies are outsourcing more and more of their work. And this thing that we call the gig economy is really just an extreme version of this. It's that you can do it on mobile phones and you can do it with something as small as a single ride, saying that that's a contract and you're hiring a freelancer to do just that. But in truth, almost every company uses independent contractors in some way or another. In my book, I followed this guy who lived in rural Arkansas, and he answered customer service calls for Sears. So he'd pick up the phone and say, like, hi, I'm Sears. What's your problem with your air conditioner? And his employment relationship with Sears was that he was an independent contractor that worked for a small business that had a contract with a call center, and the call center had a contract with Sears. So it's just this huge train of kind of fragmented employment, to the point where if something happens to him, you know, Sears isn't going to feel responsible. And if he's not getting paid minimum wage, you know, there's nothing to protect him from that, and no one's going to point at Sears. And that, too, is enabled by technology. He's able to work remotely. He's able to look up the information that he needs to understand the air conditioners and to sign up for his shifts in this platform where you pick them. So I just think that the things that we hear about are Uber and Lyft, and they make good stories because they're these big, you know, important, dramatic startups, but that this is really something that's much more pervasive than that.
But where are we headed? And then specifically in terms of consumer expectations, we expect these services to cost less. But is that going to have to shift? And where will that take us? As gig economy workers, they fight for better pay. Those prices are going to go up for those services.
Yeah, that's true. And it's between 20 and 30% less expensive to hire an independent contractor to do something than it is an employee. And the reason that is because as a society, we've attached kind of all of our social safety net to this employment relationship. So if you hire an employee, you have to do things like, you know, fund health insurance or pay for disability insurance. And if you're an independent contractor, you don't have any of that. But, I mean, that's still going to cost society if more and more people are working this way. And so at a certain point, we're going to pay for it. And at some point, these businesses, you know, if you can't do it quickly enough to give somebody a living wage and make them feel secure, like maybe it shouldn't exist or maybe it should cost more.
Sarah Kessler, she's the author of the book Gigged, The End of the Job and the Future of Work. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, China doesn't want our dirty recycling anymore. We better clean up our act or drown in a mountain of LaCroix cans and yogurt cups. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
It's Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogavin for Madeline Brand. It turns out recycling is just not as easy as throwing stuff in the blue bin. China buys a lot of our recyclable trash, and a little while ago, China changed what it will accept. It wants clean, well-sorted stuff. And we Americans, we're just not very good at that. So today, more and more of what we put into our blue bins doesn't get recycled. KCRW's Jenny Hamill went to find out more.
You're not kidding. Does not smell good in here.
This is one place LA County's recyclables go to get sorted, baled, and often exported. The Puente Hills Materials Recovery Facility. Despite the smell, the warehouse looks clean. There are mammoth piles of trash and recyclables neatly organized throughout the building, with bulldozers moving in and out of them.
So this is the pile of commingled recyclables that have come in this morning.
That's Bob Asgian with the LA County Sanitation Districts. We're standing in front of a massive pile, about two stories high. And the first thing you notice is it's riddled with cardboard boxes, black plastic bags, and pizza boxes. Just by looking, you can see that some of the stuff in the pile is not recyclable. But actually, even more of the stuff is headed for a landfill than you might think. Here's Lance Klug with CalRecycle, which runs the state's recycling program.
Well, we're definitely in a moment of transition, and I don't think the Chinese market is ever coming back.
For decades, China was buying a lot of what was coming out of our blue recycle bins here in LA and all over the US. China was going through a manufacturing boom and wanted our material to turn into new products. We'd send it all over, and they'd separate what's actually recyclable from what's just trash. Problem is, we were sending over a lot of dirty trash, even hazardous material.
So, for example, when manufacturers or processors in China purchase bales of material, say plastic, and they got things like garden hoses, broken glass, electronics mixed in with that, you know, that created a challenge, excess garbage, and that's pretty much the issue that they're confronting right now.
China inherited half the planet's trash problems, and it polluted their environment. So in January of this year, a new Chinese policy went into effect, and it banned 24 types of foreign waste from entering the country. That includes a lot of plastics and mixed paper. China also implemented a really tough contamination standard. If any given bale of recyclables is less than 99.5% clean, the bale's not getting into the country. So, no greasy pizza boxes, no marinara bottles with half the sauce still lining the glass. Here's Susan Collins, president of the Container Recycling Institute.
I've been in recycling for more than 25 years, and this has definitely caused more disruption than anything I've ever seen. And I know that it will cause disruption for years to come. In some parts of the country, it is devastating, and in other parts of the country, they are far less affected by it. It is different commodity type by commodity type.
Collins says commodities hit hard on the West Coast are paper and plastics with the numbers 3 through 7 on the bottoms of the containers, like those yogurt cups, for instance. This is Kobe Sky, chief engineer at LA County's Public Works Department, which runs the county's recycle program.
For the last several years, we've been incredibly reliant on China for taking the lion's share of the recyclable materials.
But China can't be relied on anymore. So what happens to that stuff you put in the blue bin? Here's Bob Asgian again.
So the soda can boxes we're no longer able to sell. We've got these plastic vegetable containers that we're no longer able to sell. That marinara jar that you just talked about, well, that maybe broke on this cardboard box right here. That's no longer, we can't sell that. It's a big chunk of cardboard, but we can't sell it.
Because it's soiled.
It's soiled. Pizza boxes, same thing. There's a Gatorade bottle that has half the liquid still in it, right? That's just going to contaminate everything that if we were to try to recover that and bale it, it would squirt everywhere and contaminate everything.
So really, what you're looking for down here is clean...
clean paper, clean cardboard... and aluminum cans, glass bottles, plastic bottles of various grades.
Right. But they have to be clean.
Clean, free of liquid, yes.
Asgian says they can't sell the yogurt cups, the plastic clamshell containers, shredded paper, our soda can boxes, envelopes with plastic laminated to them. The list goes on. Brown paper bags, they're actively looking for a market to sell to. These new policies have forced the Puente Hills Materials Recovery Facility to really slow down its production lines because sorters have to be meticulous about what ends up in those bales. That means even higher production costs. And while some material is being sold to different markets domestically or other countries like Vietnam and the Philippines, it's at significantly lower prices, especially when it comes to paper. All of this means it's costing more to run recycling programs, which will fall on each city and homeowner. And then there's the question of what happens to all the material that can't be recycled. Here's Asgian again.
After we separate out the recyclables from the non-contaminated recyclables, then the rest of it's going to go to the landfill. And unfortunately, at much higher percentages than it has been in the past.
Lance Klug with CalRecycle said during the first 3 months of 2017, California exported 54,000 tons of mixed plastics. During the first quarter of this year, the state exported 5,000 tons of mixed plastics, less than a tenth of what was exported the year before.
Officials are scrambling, figuring out ways to work around an export market that has pretty much collapsed. In the long term, they point to developing more local recycling markets or expanding the use of conversion technology to turn trash into methane, which is widely used in Europe. But that would take time, money, and political will. Here's Susan Collins with the Container Recycling Institute again.
Well, I think the most important thing that's needed right now is for a little less burying our heads in the sand and a little more transparency about what's really happening to the materials. The municipalities and the waste collectors and recycling collectors are coming to grips with this issue, and it's really sinking in that it's real and it's here to stay.
In the meantime, engineer Kobe Skye with the LA County Public Works Department said, when in doubt of what to recycle, the most important message he wants to get to the public is this.
Keep recycling. All of this news and concern about contamination, we don't want that to discourage people from putting materials in a blue bin, but we're hoping that the message is, try and make sure that it's cleaner.
Remember, what's in your blue bin gets mixed with material from all your neighbors' blue bins when it goes from curbside to the truck. So the simple point is, the cleaner your material, the more likely it's going to be recycled. For KCRW, I'm Jenny Hamill.
And to find out more about what you can and can't recycle, go to kcrw.com/curious. Heads up, if you're a woman experiencing out-of-the-ordinary discomfort above the waist, this cardiologist has some life or death advice.
You can quote me on this. I tell my patients to, when they go to the emergency room, say that they are having chest pain, even if they're not.
Otherwise, a male doctor might not think to check your heart. New research shows that women are more likely to die from a heart attack if their doctor is a man. Medicine and gender bias. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave. Heart disease is the leading cause of death in the United States, but symptoms of the disease and of heart attacks can differ between men and women. The classic heart attack, the one we see in the movies where a pasty middle-aged man clutches his chest in pain, it can play out like that for women too. But women are more likely than men to experience a silent heart attack, one with no overt symptoms at all. At the most, maybe indigestion or nausea, back or neck pain. The kind of discomfort that wouldn't necessarily have you rushing to the emergency room. Well, multiple studies have shown that women are, on the whole, less likely to survive heart attacks than men. And according to a new study, that could be because of the gender of the doctors who treat them. Laura Huang is one of the authors of the study and a professor of business administration at Harvard Business School. Welcome to Press Play.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Well, you and your colleagues studied two whole decades of records from a Florida hospital, and you noticed this correlation between the gender of the doctors treating women admitted with a heart attack and the women's survival rate. What is the correlation?
We kind of set out... We're all studying, you know, organizations, and we've been interested in this phenomenon around, you know, glass ceilings, around inequality, and really what's happening in a variety of different contexts, including hiring decisions, promotion decisions, who gets venture capital financing, and those sorts of things. And what we found in this data was that a lot of those findings were being mirrored by what we saw in the medical data. That's when male physicians are treating female patients, female patients are less likely to survive heart attacks or acute myocardial infarctions.
And how much less likely or how much better are the outcomes for women treated by women?
There's a number of different ways to think about the effect size, but the relative mortality rate goes up by 12% if you're a female patient and see a male physician. And so what that equates to is that you see an increased absolute risk of about 1.5%, or roughly one in 66 women suffer because they see a male doctor.
Why do you think this is? And I'm thinking we've been hearing for years now that almost all of this early heart disease research was done on men and not on women. So is it about the research, or is it because women often present with these symptoms that are harder to diagnose? Or is it the way that men and women communicate and the lack of communication between female patients and male doctors?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're tapping into a lot of things that all are contributing to this, right? Perhaps it's that male physicians are communicating in a certain way with their male patients as opposed to female patients. It could be the comfort at which patients are finding themselves able to communicate with their attending physician. It could be something much more implicit, right, where there's a tacit type of understanding or a tacit norm in differences in treatment. It could also be something just around attention. What is it that physicians are paying attention to? And, you know, we do show that when male physicians have more female colleagues in their midst, that the effect is actually attenuated. We're less likely to see this result when male physicians have lots of female colleagues. We also see that when male physicians have treated more female patients in the past, that they're also less likely to have this effect. So it does suggest that there's something around either attention or implicit tacit knowledge that they're picking up when they are surrounded by lots of other women or when they've had experience treating lots of other female patients and so on and so forth.
Laura Huang, professor of business administration at Harvard Business School, thanks so much for this.
Thanks for the interest in our research.
And let's turn now to a doctor who has firsthand experience with all of this. Dr. Noelle Barry-Murs has studied for years the differences between men and women with heart disease and the way they're treated. She's the director of the Barbara Streisand Women's Heart Center in the Smith Heart Institute at Cedars-Sinai. Good of you to come on the show.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So does anything surprise you in Laura Huang's research?
I think what was surprising was how robust the findings were. We've always sort of known other articles, other publications, other research have suggested this in a more general sense. Female surgeons seem to improve surgical team outcomes. Female internists managing patients hospitalized seem to do better than male internists. So this is not surprising, but what was really great was just the rigor of this analysis conducted by professors of information and decision science, business corporate strategy, and organizational behavior in business schools. So they're agnostic. They have no skin in this game, and they have the methods. They have the amazing modeling that is just really very rigorous and just shows us how important this is.
Well, what do you make of this communication piece? I mean, do you think women are more comfortable explaining their symptoms to other women, or maybe they feel better heard? Maybe they are better heard. And I'm thinking anecdotally, I know a number of women who have presented with these kind of amorphous symptoms. Their male doctors have not even considered a heart attack or heart disease. And in one case, it took a friend's brother, who is a physician, talking to her doctor to convince him that that this friend of mine does not get hysterical, does not make too much of things, wouldn't be making a fuss about nothing. And that's what convinced this doctor to consider heart disease.
No, that anecdote clearly evidences a strong implicit bias that we and others have described in our dominantly male physician workforce. And it is, it's implicit. It's a bias that we all have. Men seem to have it more strongly than women. If you've ever wondered about yourself, go to the Harvard website and take the implicit bias test, because you can do it for gender, you can do it for ethnicity. The other thing that is well described in the medical literature is for physician interaction with patients, if you map out the airtime, female physicians spend more time listening. Male physicians spend more time talking.
And getting to this diagnosis issue, how much more difficult can it be for an ER doctor, any doctor, to diagnose when a woman is having a heart attack?
Well, again, women are also, female physicians are more often following what we call guidelines or protocols. And, you know, anybody that comes into the emergency room with any symptom above the waist should have an EKG and a troponin drawn. That's pretty much protocol. What happens then, probably, and this would be future research, is to show that these ED female physicians are more likely following the protocol and the male physicians are not, because they think it doesn't add up to them, implicit bias, it's wasted time and energy, all of the things that the Me Too movement has, you know, this is a Me Too movement in medicine.
But what do you make of this other finding that when male doctors have more female colleagues, that they have better success rates treating female patients?
Well, again, this is well supported by other data. When we look at other research looking at fathers who have professional daughters, these fathers are less likely to have this inherent gender bias. So now translate that to male physicians who have a physician that they work alongside, and they have coffee together, and they talk about cases, and they might even socialize together, because this is, you know, what doctors do. That's our peer group. And so they're exposed, and they do better just by simple exposure. And this is the kind of networking that doctors do all the time. You know, hey, you know, Dr. Jane, you're following the protocol in that young woman? Why are you doing that? Oh, Dr. Joe, you don't know that heart disease is the leading killer of young women? Oh, I didn't know that.
You should do a puppet show. Mm-hmm. So you see it more in terms of bias rather than female colleagues talking with male colleagues, sharing this anecdotal evidence, male colleagues getting more up to date on recognizing symptoms and how they present in women.
I don't know that it's all implicit bias. I wouldn't overstate that. I think that there are issues that female physicians will personalize. They'll pay more attention to it if it was all in the curriculum. So I think that's true, because they're women and they know that, you know, women are underserved. That's the Me Too movement. And then I think it's also following protocols. And women are more likely to follow protocols. That was one of the major hypotheses or theories to support why female internists, their inpatients, the patients that are hospitalized, do better than the ones that were managed by the male internists. Women were following protocols.
Well, what symptoms then should women really look out for, whether they're at a higher risk of heart disease or not? Because that was another issue with my anecdotal story there. My friend had no idea that these symptoms that she was having could possibly indicate heart disease.
Well, you know, you have to start by the well-known and, but unfortunately, often minimized fact that heart disease is the leading killer of women at all ages. And so then you have to say, hey, anything above the belly button, if it's something that you haven't experienced before and is not known and it's above the waist, you should go get checked out. And that's pretty clear protocol at this point. And so folks that override that, they might be right some of the time, but they're going to be wrong some of the time. And that's where heart attacks are missed. And a missed heart attack, because heart attacks are often lethal, a missed heart attack can result in death. And that's a big mistake.
And in terms of advocating for yourself when you get to the ER, when you go to see your cardiologist or any doctor?
Well, actually, and you can quote me on this, I tell my patients to, when they go to the emergency room, say that they are having chest pain, even if they're not, because that's code. If you go into an emergency room, even a male physician, if you say you're having chest pain, we'll order that EKG and that troponin.
Well, that is a good tip, and we will quote you. The name is Dr. Noelle Barry Mers, and she's director of the Barbara Streisand Women's Heart Center in the Schmidt Heart Institute at Cedars-Sinai. Thank you.
Oh, thank you for this important attention. This is a critically important issue.
And Warren Olney is here with a check-in on what's coming up on his latest podcast. Hey, Warren.
Hi.
It's so nice to see you.
Nice to see you.
So what are you talking about?
Well, Israel was founded on two principles, one that it would be the Jewish state, the other that it would be a pluralistic democracy. And now they have passed a new law in the Knesset, very close vote, very controversial in Israel, saying that it is unique to the Jews. And that has caused a huge problem. 21% of the people are, in fact, Arabs. They have downgraded the Arab language. This has caused a problem not only within Israel, but it has also divided Jews here in this country. And we're going to hear from both of them.
Really interesting. Just four words.
That's right.
To the Jews. I can't wait. Thanks for this.
Okay.
The new film Crazy Rich Asians is the first all-Asian-led Hollywood movie in 25 years. We meet director John M. Chu. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave from Madeline Brand. For the first time in 25 years, a major Hollywood studio is out with a film featuring an all-Asian cast. Crazy Rich Asians is based on Kevin Kwan's best-selling novel of the same name. It follows an American-born Chinese woman named Rachel Chu. She goes to Singapore with her boyfriend, Nick Young. They're there for his best friend's wedding and so that he can introduce her to his family. But he left out one key detail. His family has a lot of money. Her good friend, played by rap star and actress Awkwafina, lays it out.
Rachel, these people aren't just rich, okay? They're crazy rich. Look, there's new money all over Asia. We got the Beijing billionaires, the Taiwan tycoons, but the Young family, they're old money rich. They had money when they left China in the 1800s, and they went all the way down here. Not there. Here. They came to Singapore when there was nothing but jungle and pig farmers. It was a snake here eating an apple. You know what I mean? And they built all of this. Now, they're the landlords of the most expensive city in the world. Here you go. These people are so posh and snobby, they're snoshy.
John M. Chu directed Crazy Rich Asians. His other credits include Now You See Me 2, G.I. Joe, Retaliation, and Step Up 2. And he's here with us now. And thank you so much for coming
in,
John.
So nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, just so anyone listening can get a sense of the tone of Crazy Rich Asians, how do you describe it to people? I mean, is it a wacky rom-com like Meet the Parents or more of this funny, touching class conflict love story like, say, Pretty Woman?
Mm-hmm. I mean, it has a bit of both, actually. That's what's, I think, unique about this. It doesn't fit into one category. I mean, I think we're marketing it as a romantic comedy, and it has definitely those elements, and we have homages to those things. But at the end of the day, it is about an Asian-American going to Asia for the first time. And it's something that I personally have experienced, that feeling of coming home to a place that you didn't expect and don't know is your home, and realizing that they treat you like their son at that store, and they treat you like a cousin at that store. And then they call you something like Guaylo, which means like white devil. And you're like, oh, I don't belong here. And then you go home and you feel like you have to choose between these two things. So we deal with that. But at the same time, there's this crazy, wacky, rich Asian world, old money, new money, that this is happening in. Everyone goes through this idea of trying to find our place in this world. And for me, I always felt I was alone in that. And hopefully this movie tells others out there that you're not alone in your sort of remixed cultural identity.
Well, yeah, you really pack a lot into this rom-com. And I'm thinking 25 years, that is such a long time to wait for a mainstream Asian-centered movie, especially when you consider just what a big critical and financial success The Joy Luck Club was.
Yeah, I remember going to The Joy Luck Club. My dad got us all in our minivan on a Sunday morning at 10 a.m., the first screen, the cheapest screening, and we watched it as a family together. I'm the youngest of five kids. My parents came from China and Taiwan when they were teenagers, and we watched this movie, and it was the first time we'd seen our conversations on the big screen. We went to dim sum afterwards, and we ate for 4 hours and talked about the movie, quoted the movie. And that moment has stuck with me as one of the key pieces of cinema that has influenced my life. And so to know that nothing has been made in the Hollywood system of that style until now is insane to me. But that's where we are. And so we knew that we couldn't just do it to do it. We had to make a great movie. So this wasn't and we had to start a bigger movement that's already sort of in motion so that more stories and more writers and more directors and more actors can come from this little crack to build more.
So had you always wanted to make this kind of movie? Because you're when I look at your resume, yeah. I mean, it's pretty action-packed.
Yes,
it's action-oriented. It's not exactly, it doesn't sing of rom-com.
No, the last thing I wanted to do was talk about my own ethnicity. If you're the only Asian in the room, you don't want to call yourself out as being the only Asian in the room. At least I felt like that my whole life. And my parents, you know, they came without speaking a word of English to America. So they were enveloped in that and knew how it felt to be the outsider. So they made sure that we did other things. They never let us work at the restaurant. They put us in dance classes, in sports camps, in animation classes, and all these drums, saxophone, violin, guitar, piano. I played all these things. And so I never had to really deal with it. I just sort of focused on the work and the stuff, which was a great way to live. But at a certain point, as I got older as a filmmaker, all this uproar online about whitewashed out and lack of diversity and representation, I agreed with that. And I looked at like, yeah, what's wrong with Hollywood? And then I saw myself and I was like, I'm part of that problem. If I am not even doing it, then who else understands this culture, this this dilemma the way that I do? And so I took it upon myself. It was a sort of change in my brain to focus on something that would be very personal and deal with my cultural identity. Something I hadn't done. I did one student film about my cultural identity and no one has ever seen it because I buried it. It's so sensitive and I know I don't have all the answers. And so it's almost more scary to put it out there when you're going through it at the same time.
And there's some really interesting connections in this path you took to this mm-hmm. movie. Aren't you mentioned in Kevin Kwan's novel?
It's so bizarre. So I did not know this. When I got the movie is when Kevin and I met, and he didn't even reveal it then. But he's friends with my cousin, Vivian Chu, and she would tell him stories of the Chus of Cupertino, where we were from. And so the Chus in the book from Cupertino.
Those infamous Chus.
We were a big, crazy family. And so he wrote a lot of the stuff from her story. One of the cousins is a director in Hollywood. And I remember reading that line being like, that's weird. That's so like me. But I read a lot of things that you sort of think is you. But to find out that actually is a very strange, strange moment. And that's actually when I knew I'm meant to do this movie. Win or lose, I'm supposed to do this movie. And it actually gave me a lot of confidence that I could just lay it out there.
Huh. Well, you and Kevin Kwan collaborated on the film. How did that work? Because that's pretty unusual. Did he react to deviations from his
story?
He's
the best creative partner you could ask for. Usually, and I know how it goes, and the author wants it to be like the book.
It's hard to tear themselves away.
So hard.
From their creation. Yeah.
But what's great about Kevin is he's a film buff, bigger film buff than myself. He knows movies like the back of his hand and can take directors and things. And that's why I think the book was sort of written cinematically in a way. But we couldn't do the book. The book is just so packed with stuff. You can't fit all of us. We had to focus. And my way in was the personal angle of Rachel Chu, an Asian American going to Asia for the first time. So seeing Singapore through this point of view would give our audience a way in unlike any other. And to know that even an Asian in Asia, Asian American, would be sort of attacked and picked apart by that family. So he let me do whatever, and we would discuss things. He had a great advice on character, on costumes, on places. So that was a great partnership.
Well, we have a clip, actually, that speaks exactly to that. And it's about Nick's mother, whose name is Eleanor, and she's played by veteran Malaysian-born actress Michelle Yeoh, who's known for starring in Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, and also Memoirs of a Geisha. And Eleanor, she is a traditional wife, and she is just focused like a laser on her family. And she is initially very critical of Rachel, who is a modern Chinese-American-born woman. So let's listen to this scene of them at dinner, and Nick is there too.
That's a beautiful ring, Auntie Eleanor.
Nick's father had it made when he proposed to me.
How did you guys meet?
So they met at Cambridge. They're both studying law together.
Oh, I didn't know you were a lawyer.
I withdrew from university when we got married.
Oh.
I chose to help my husband run a business and to raise a family. For me, it was a privilege. But for you, you may think it's old-fashioned. But all this doesn't just happen. It's because we know to put family first.
And Eleanor, of course, is being very intentional, understatedly intentional, implying that an Asian American girl like Rachel is just too modern for her son and too individualistic. Mm-hmm. Right. So this sounds like this was your central, your driving theme from the start.
Absolutely. This is a debate I had in my head for years all growing up. The American way and what I grew up in was follow your dreams. If you are happy, that's the point of your life. Make yourself happy. And at the same time, my parents also taught me family first. Sacrifice your own happiness for the group. So there are these two conflicting ideas that both had legitimate sort of roots. How does a kid manage those two things? And I felt very alone in that. What I realized is everyone's going through those, especially any sort of traditional cultural background. You have conflicting ideas. And even Michelle, when I first called her for this, I was like, she is Eleanor Young. Power in just her posture and her eyes.
Such dignity.
Such dignity. And she said to me, she said, if you want me to play a villain in this movie, then I'm not going to do it. I have to defend my culture in the way that I know it, and otherwise I won't be able to go home. She said, you defend the American side the way, you know, you would talk to your mom about it, and let's see what happens. And it was such a beautiful recipe.
That makes for so many layers in your character, because there must have been a temptation to make the mother-in-law the villain.
You could have a lot of juice if she just like was evil every time. You could really get the audience on your side, but that's not what we were trying to say. That's not the message. It's much more complicated than that. And what's great is you had Constance Wu on the other side, these two trains heading towards each other of power, and Lisa Liu, who's an amazing Chinese actor, 92 years old, a force to be reckoned with her own traditional ideas. So this trio heading towards this train wreck, and Constance in that scene where they face off, Michelle first said, oh, you know, just so you know, in the script, I wouldn't let her ever say that to me. I would like squash her. And then she's like, I'm going to say this to make sure she doesn't squash her. I'm like, great. And then for Constance, she was like, oh, I would not let her talk to me like that. I would say this. So in a weird way, we had two different scripts going on at the same time for that final confrontation. And when we shot it, we just let them go. And when you see the fierceness in their eyes and both standing their grounds, that is the power of our whole movie. We knew our movie depended on that scene alone.
Wow. So everyone was keyed into this central idea, that conflict between your two different identities and your two different experiences.
Absolutely. And it's something that we all had debated with, whether they had kids or with your parents. And it's not just a cultural thing. It's a generational thing. When Constance walks away, her mom is there, and she didn't come from money. And her mom gives this look to Eleanor, like this has been a conflict for many, many years, a class conflict as well. And that this generation, this era, could be the bridge to end all of these things.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with John M. Chu, director of the new movie Crazy Rich Asians. Constance Wu, you've been talking about her. She's the star of the ABC show Fresh Off the Boat, and she is really believable, really appealing as Rachel, but I understand you almost didn't get her.
Yeah, we were wooing her. And we found out that our dates didn't match up. She was on her amazingly successful show. So we moved on. And then I got an impassioned email from her one day. She was on an airplane. And she said she didn't want to let an opportunity go by unless she said this out loud, that how important to her making a movie, her first studio movie, about a strong Asian female, for all females, all Asians all around, how important that was to her. And she said, please wait for me, basically. I'm meant to do this part. And it took very short amount of time for me to talk to the producers and the studio, where they were like, let's hold everything. She is the center rock for this movie.
Such investment by all your actors. What a privilege.
I know. That's what this was not a regular movie to cast. Everyone had such emotions to bring to the table. When I think about our cast and the confidence that they bring to the screen, Awkwafina, a rapper, Asian rapper from Queens, Flushing, to Ronnie Chang from The Daily Show, Jimmy O. Yang, all these people, Michelle, they have all gone through the gauntlet of their own personal journeys and have come out stronger and more unique than so many people. And to have them all on one screen, I think, bleeds off of that and is contagious to the audience.
We've got to talk about Awkwafina.
Oh, yeah.
Because, I mean, she's a scene stealer as a rapper. There's no doubt about that. You
yes.
might know her from her song, My Vag. And she
yes.
was also in Seth Rogen's Neighbors 2 and Ocean's 8. But in this movie, I mean, she plays Rachel's old college friend in just this big old blonde wig and designer silk PJs. And she has lots of animal prints. And she's just larger than life. And her family's rich, but just nowhere near as rich as God, as the Youngs. So Is this a real life type you have encountered, or just a comic foil for Rachel? And how much of it came from Awkwafina, just her performance? Mm-hmm. How much was off script and how much was on?
Well, definitely the book does not describe her friend in this way. I don't think anyone could write a personality like Awkwafina brings to the screen. A lot of it was her improvisation, but there were the things that we wrote that part once we knew we had her around who she was. So the irreverence, the unapologetic sort of force of nature that she is, we knew would bring life. We're pretty earnest in this movie. We have earnest moments, and she can like flip it on a dime. This is her Jiminy Craig. This is our Rachel Chu's sort of conscience, and she speaks the truth throughout. And she actually, because she's young and I don't know, she just made this the whole thing much more contemporary and cool, and that was really fun to have.
So how did you end up with a novice actor BBC travel host for your lead, too? That's who plays Nick Young.
Our accountant in Malaysia was like, hey, there's this guy who hosted this award show 5 years ago, and I can't get him out of my mind for this role. And all our assistants are in love with him. So I was like, yeah. I mean, I got many emails during that time about friends of friends who were good-looking Asian dudes. So I looked him up on Instagram doing my due diligence, and it was amazing. He's a travel host, so he's an adventurer, and he's with people, and he's amongst the people. You could tell that he had this magnetic personality, ease, not trying to be cool, not trying to be suave. He just was. It's very much like a JFK Jr. type, out in the open, and at the same time, an aristocrat. That he could dress up and look amazing. So these two things, I cyber-stalked him and found that we had a mutual friend on Facebook, of all things, Steve Jiang in the Bay Area. And so I hit up my friend and I said, hey, do you know this guy? And he's like, oh, he's not an actor. He's a host, but I'll connect you. He's like the life of the party. I met him at a wedding. So that's how we started this conversation. I pulled him from his honeymoon in South Africa where he was and didn't promise him the part, but just said, you should come do this audition. And he did it. And fate took hold, and now he's on every bus stop out here in LA.
Oh, the internet has gone crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, he is a media sensation. Is this a breakout film for him already?
Oh, absolutely. And this is a story I've never heard before, how fast this is happening for him.
Well, this is a story I haven't heard recently either, that you turned down a crazy rich offer from Netflix to make
yes.
this film.
Yes. By the way, I love Netflix. The only thing for this project in particular, at this era, to put something up on the screen, which takes marketing dollars, bigger budget, and you have to convince people to leave their home, fight traffic, stand in line, sit in a dark room, spend money, and say, tell me a story, and sit there for 2 hours. That sends a signal to everyone when big corporations say, it is worth your time. This Asian love story is worth your time and energy. It is in the action of a studio that is paying tens of million dollars to market this.
So that's what you wanted. You wanted the Joy Luck Club.
Yeah, we wanted that and more. We wanted that for this generation to encourage the other filmmakers and other stories that are out there to get to the front line so we can see their stories. This movie cannot represent every Asian person in the world. It cannot be the only thing we have. It has to only crack it so it's good business. And then better stories, better scripts, better actors, all these things as everybody gets better, because by having more roles, everything diversifies and you get more experience. That's what we want. I want 10 years from now to this not be a thing. So we look back and we're like, oh, Crazy Rich Asians was the first. That was a thing back then. And I hope that people don't remember that, actually.
You know, I was sitting in a screening. It got to a moment during a wedding, not Nick and Rachel's wedding,
yep.
but they are kind of communicating across the whole field of wedding guests mm-hmm. to each other. She's mm-hmm. sitting in the audience, and he's the best man. And there was somebody sobbing behind me, but there were definitely a lot of, sniffles.
Yeah, it meant a lot. One in the book describes this wedding, way over the top wedding, but it's really not about the wedding. It's about these two people who've gone through thick and thin and are on the edge of maybe even breaking up. But it's this in this setting that they realize they're going to spend or they want to spend the rest of their life with this other. It's the first time they say, I love you. It's the first time. So it was not about the wedding. It was about human beings and finding connection and seeing their lives with each other.
Well, I just wish you the best with this
film.
Thank
you. Thank you so much.
John M. Chu, director of the new movie Crazy Rich Asians. It opens August 15th. And that's it for us for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.